Excellent. So my clock now has 8 o'clock. A few more people coming in. So again, welcome to the first morning talk of this 9-day retreat. And I try to make sure that the morning talks give some sort of theme or some sort of instructions in order to guide the meditation. But you'll find that the instructions which I give are not do this and then do that and then do something else. Because every human being is totally unique. Can you hear me okay with the mask on? Some say no, okay. Please excuse me, I'll take the mask down a bit. Is that better? Okay. That when we... sneeze. That's okay. So, you want to cough or sneeze? That's no trouble at all.
I think she was reminded that she didn't have hers on.
Oh, I didn't have hers on. Oh, okay. Sorry. But anyway, if anyone doesn't like to wear the mask, they can please come up here and give the talk instead of me. I'm not going to sit quiet in the back. Very good. Okay. So, I think you've already got some of the important part of this retreat is to take it softly and kindly. And all that actually comes back to understanding that what this path of meditation really is. Yes, mindfulness is really important, but what is actually that mindfulness? Where does it lead? And that mindfulness, oh, there's some more people coming in. That mindfulness does lead to what we call samadhi. That's a Pali word, but it's used so often. And many, many people tend to be told that that means, in English, concentration. For those who have listened to me so many times, that was one of the worst pieces of advice which stopped many people getting into deep meditation. Samadhi does not mean concentration. Samadhi means stillness. And the idea of stillness is reflected in asking everybody to try and keep noble silence. So the sound is still. That's why we built a place out here in the bush where it's reasonably silent. Made sure we were not on flight paths when we built this place. When I say that, there's some traffic on the road. Because usually the traffic on the road is very little, if at all. And that idea of stillness on the outside does tend to resonate with what we're doing inside of our meditation, allowing the mind to be still. And that stillness, instead of concentration is something you do. Stillness is something which happens when you stop doing things. It's very opposite. And because of that, many people, they try to be still. Many people, they try to meditate. Many people try to let go, and they fail. You can't try to let go. You let go of trying. You abandon that. Just watch. Hear. Know. Without reacting. Allow this moment to be. And sometimes when I say that, it's how do you let this moment be? It is with kindness. If you're kind to something, then it's very easy to watch. Sometimes, I've seen, especially mothers, we use that simile in the morning chanting. Just like a mother loves her only child. If you love a child that much, that the child feels safe in your arms. Of course, this must have happened to me many times when I was a baby. But I've seen mothers doing this, and I'm just in awe at the baby's confidence. Have you seen mothers holding their baby in a shopping center? They're holding their baby there and they're jostling here, jostling over there, looking for this shop, looking for that shop. And they never, I've never ever seen a mother drop her baby. And if I was that baby now, I'd think, I can't go to sleep. I can't, because my mum might drop me any old time. So what it is, that kindness, that sense of safety, which a mother gives her child, means the child can go fast asleep in its mother's arms, going through the shopping centre, down busy streets, or whatever. It can relax because of the safety which the mother's kindness gives it. And that's the same for each one of you. So of the kindness which I and the nuns just try and spread to each one of you, and the kindness you give to your own body, allows your body to relax. When it starts relaxing, then it can disappear. And this is one of the reasons why the kindness is such an important part of the meditation. In those early days, I used to go to some meditation retreats, and that's what was missing, the kindness. You're supposed to sit there, don't move. Sit there for an hour. And there was something, to me, terribly wrong about that. It wasn't being kind and being sensitive to every person's body on these retreats. It was one of the reasons why that sometimes, you know, people ask me, and you read about this on the internet articles, sometimes people say that meditation can be dangerous. If you don't do it correctly, of course it can be dangerous. Water is very dangerous. You can drown in it. But it's also, if you know how to use it, people swim in it and they can drink it. And it's not dangerous at all. It's just how it's used. If meditation is used with kindness, care, you find that you feel safe, safe enough to let go. When you let go, that is when you get stillness. I thought about this simile earlier, but I thought, no, I won't use it today, but here it is. The simile of the cup of water. Many of you have seen this before, but here it comes again. I need a volunteer. Come on, our retreat manager. You can come up. Now, first of all, I ask you...
It's supposed to be his job. I delegate.
No. Okay, sit down there. Now, are you an honest woman?
When I want to be. That would be a yes.
That's honest, that's yes, okay. Will you be honest now?
Yes.
Okay, very good. That was hard. Now, the question is, this cup of water... In many, many different cultures, the water is a simile for the mind. And that's, I think, I remember reading that in some book about the symbols of man and woman as well. And so this is my mind, the water. Now I'm going to try and hold this water perfectly still. Many of you have seen this before, but it's just emphasizing an important point. When you just say something, it doesn't really get in that much. But when you demonstrate it, people remember it. And they can easily explain it to others. I'll hold this water as still as I can. Has it stopped moving yet?
No.
Why? I'm not even watching it. I'm not being aware. I'm not being mindful. So now I'm mindful. Has the water stopped moving yet?
No.
Why? Because I haven't put forth any effort yet. Now I'll be mindful and put forth effort. Has it stopped moving?
Nope.
Am I right in saying it's moving more when I put forth effort?
Yes.
Is that ringing any bells for you? The more effort you put in, sometimes your meditation gets worse. So how can I get this water to be perfectly still? It's so easy, yes. You let go, renounce, put it down, leave it alone. Does it stop moving yet?
Not quite.
Exactly. And then you need patience. Just wait. Don't do this like many people do. Is it peaceful yet? No, not yet. Leave it alone, be patient. As I said to somebody at the beginning of this retreat, please, 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 don't get enlightened in the first couple of days. Otherwise you'll have nothing to do for the rest of the week. Relax. How about that?
Pretty good.
Yeah, it's pretty good. That's perfectly still. Excellent. Are you being honest? Yeah?
Yes.
Thank you. So a big round of applause to the retreat manager. Okay, now I just went into that overmuch. Many of you have seen it before, but it's important. That's why I reinforced it by doing it for a long period of time, making a few funny stories, because you can see that if you try to hold your mind still, it doesn't become still at all. If you put it down, let it go, disengage. It's not yours. It's not your problem. It doesn't belong to you. Then you can let it go. When I let it go, it becomes really still all by itself. So, how do you do that in meditation? What are you letting go of, first of all? First of all of your past and your future. Oh my goodness, all your history. What have you done in the past? What terrible things have you done? Terrible things have been done to you. There's been lots. You know why I know that is true? Because this is the human realm. It's not some heavenly realm. If you weren't sort of faulty, you wouldn't have been reborn here. I'm being honest, straight up. So you all got your little things in the past, things you think you should have done and you didn't do. But being kind, and one of the things about the past which I love focusing on is something which, you know, I call, for want of a better term, the 70% rule. And the 70% rule is what I learned when I was a school teacher. I was asked to set an exam in mathematics. And I don't like exams. Because, you know, what do exams actually do? And that piece of graffiti which I remember seeing on the walls of Cambridge University when I was a student there, exams kill by degrees. It's a nice little funny statement, but it's so true. And certainly it does kill your willingness to investigate, to explore, to find new things. When all you really pressure to do is to pass an exam. So instead of that, that, you know, exams kill by degrees, when I had to set an exam, because that's my job, I just asked someone, what should I do? And they gave this wonderful piece of advice, the 70% rule. Try to set the exam so the average score is 70%. That's the best score, 70% on average. If everybody scores 100% or 90% or something, then the exam's too easy. What purpose has it? If it's too hard, so everyone scores 30%, 40% or something, then all of your students will come away thinking they can't do maths. So try and aim for 70%. It's a reasonably good score. You've done 70%. Well done. And the where they make their mistakes, that is what's called feedback for their teacher. As for me, so I could find out where they were weak, what they didn't know, what I thought I'd explained, but I hadn't explained well. And I thought that was such a wonderful explanation of what exams are for. Not to torture people, not so people think, hey, I'm top of the class, I'm really good. So every time I give talks, I always remember these stupid, funny stories. When I was that teacher, this was a year afterwards, teaching at a high school for 1 year, there was, you know what happens, you remember your school years. One of the kids in my class came bottom of the class. One kid had to come bottom of the class. Even if I had a class of 30 geniuses, 30 Einsteins, one had to be the worst Einstein in the class. But you know, because they came bottom of the class and I gave out the report cards. Remember those report cards you used to just hand out? And he opened his report card, came bottom. And I looked at him, because I'd seen the report cards. This was the first time he knew he came bottom of the class. And he looked, he's a boy, I looked at him as soon as he saw that. His facial composure just dropped, his shoulders drooped, his eyes went down. He felt not just shame, the coming bottom of the class, but he started to know what would happen when the other kids in the class knew that he was bottom of the class. When he went home to see his parents and gave the report card, he came bottom of the class. Oh my goodness, he was thinking of all of the treats which he wouldn't get, all of the pocket money which he used to get in those days would be taken away from him. Came bottom of the class, you have to do better next year, blah, blah, blah. So he was actually afraid. When I went up to him, I looked him in the eye and said, you come bottom of the class. Yes, sir, I'm sorry. I said, no, don't say sorry. I've come here to praise you. They knew I was a Buddhist. I didn't keep it quiet. Actually, the first time I taught meditation was to the school kids. You did an assembly, and I taught 650 kids, boys and girls from 11 to 17, meditation every morning for 1 week. And that was actually amazing, because I don't know, but maybe I was just a bit arrogant, overconfident or something, but I asked the headmaster, said, yeah, go for it, give it a try. So when he went up there, this is easy, only 60 of you, 65 or whatever, I don't know how many are here. But when you were teaching 650 high school kids, boys and girls, in the little ones, and they'd never done any meditation before in their lives. So I said, they're all sitting on the floor, that was a good start. Now I said, sort of close your eyes, they'll close your eyes. Now sort of backs up straight. I had my eyes open. It was like, I think they call them these days Mexican waves, the whole auditorium, they all sort of straightened up their backs. Put your right hand in your left hand, you know, close your eyes, and just watch your breath go in and out, just for 5 minutes. And the amazing thing was, everyone cooperated. Not one kid opened their eyes or giggled or anything. And then afterwards, I said, okay, now meditation's over. You know what they did? They all gave me an ovation. Honestly, they did. And I thought, wow, that's really nice. But afterwards, only afterwards, one of the teachers said, what would you have done if one of those kids started giggling? I never even thought about that possibility. I just thought... And then when they said, what if they started giggling? I realized I was really sort of chancing my luck there. Because if you only needed one kid to start giggling, and then the rest would all join in, and that would be the end of the meditation. But I always remember that. That was amazing to get all the children, 650, never meditated before in their lives, to be quiet for 5 minutes. And also to feel so good about that, they gave me ovation. It never happened again, not when I was there. But anyway, when was that? That was 1972, I think, or 3. 73, I think. It was a long time ago. But anyway... When you learn how to be still, interesting things happen. one of the interesting things which happen is that things start disappearing. And you feel good, you feel happy. One of the things which we have to disappear is the past. And I said, you should always let go of the past. And I started off telling all my memories of the past. But how can you let go and be free of the past? And number one is, I always remember in psychology that what you perceive of the past is always distorted. That was actually a pretty accurate memory. But some of the other memories I have, I think, was that really true or not true? I even remember just my brother and I, one of us had what they used to call a little disease, German measles, when we were young. I was sure it was me. My brother was sure, no, it was him. And I asked her mum, when she was still alive, which one was it? She said, I don't know, one of you. That's honest, that's what she said. So some of this time, you just wonder about your memory. And I was young at this time. You know, who's got the right memory? And you ask psychologists, and they say it's just your memory is so uncertain. It's not really faithful to what actually happened. It's more truthful to what you want to believe, your memory. That's one of the reasons why it weakens the importance of memory, when you realize how uncertain it is. We have this word in Buddhism, anicca. It doesn't mean just impermanent, it means uncertain, not reliable. You can't really trust it. Your memory is that, like that. How many times have you experienced arguing with, you know, people you love, people who are really close, even people you're friendly to? Who said what? Who did what? Why did they do that? And even you were both there at the same time, but you got different understandings of what happened. That's the nature of perception. It changes over time. Actually, how I once explained it, looking at how my perception works, especially how my memory works, it was very much the case of a similarity to what in school we used to call Chinese whispers. I don't know why they called it Chinese whispers. It could have been Sri Lankan whispers or Australian whispers or any whispers. But this was called Chinese whispers. And that was where you had a whole line of people, line up one after the other, kids. And the teacher would whisper the message to the first kid in the line. And they had to turn around and mention that to the next person in the line. I don't know how many of you were here about 3 or 4 years ago, the last time we did a New Year's party in Dhammaloka. And Venu Mudito, he introduced that. A couple of lines of people, and he whispered a Dhamma phrase into the first person, like, all things are impermanent or something. And they whispered it to the next person. They whispered it to the next person. And the message went down the line. And what comes out in the end is totally different from what, you know, you said to the first person. And that's how memory works. Every time it's repeated, every time you remember that past experience, there's a slight distortion. And then another slight distortion, another slight distortion. And that's why my favorite one, which I love quoting, was from the First World War in Europe. And in those days, you know, these were armies, and they always had to get orders from the senior people and go all the way down the line. And so the Major General gave the order, send reinforcements, we're going to advance. And he said that to his next in command, who did it to the next in command, and the next in command, all the way down the line to the captain, to the sergeant, to the corporal, and then the corporal to the troops. And the order which came out was not send reinforcements, we're going to advance. It said send 3 and 4 pence. We're going to a dance. And that was the front line of the First World War. And that's exactly the same way that memory works. So little by little, you can't trust it. What happened? What you can be do is get the most compassionate interpretation. Because it's got a lot of wiggle room, as they say these days, you can actually interpret it the worst possible thing which happened, and someone really had it in for you. I remember that was a quote by one of those comedy shows, which I remember looking at when I was a kid. It was an English comic called Sid James. Remember him, Sidney James? And this was the Carry On Up the Something or Other. And anyway, he came along, infamy, infamy. They've all got it in for me. The meaning of the word infamy. But this is just how we can interpret even a word. Infamy means like a bad reputation. But then just blaming on other people. They've all got it in for me. In other words, they've all got negative attitudes towards me already. So little by little, we look at the past and our memories and the way it works, which means we can let it go much more easily. We can don't have to be perfect. 70% is more than good enough. And as for that kid who came bottom, and actually never got around to finishing that story, but here it comes. You can always give it a positive twist, no matter what happens. So how can you give a positive twist to a positive interpretation of someone who's come bottom of the class? And I'm his teacher. I'm the one who's supposed to be scolding him or something, but I just can't do that. Instead I said, look, you know I'm a Buddhist, yes sir. You know this thing about a bodhisattva? A bodhisattva is somebody who's supposed to sacrifice their own well-being so other people don't have to suffer. And that's you. You decided to take this terrible position of bottom of the class on purpose. I know you're much better than this. You decided to elect to be bottom of the class and do rotten in the exam so that your friends don't have to suffer like you're going to suffer this evening when your parents find out. You are a bodhisattva. You don't think about yourself, you think about others. You're my hero, and I'm going to go to the principal of this school after the class finishes, and I'm going to nominate you for Bodhisattva of the Year award in this class. That's pretty much how he looked at me, just as if I was a crazy teacher. But at least it took his perception away from failure, perception away from that he's no good. And he laughed, and the rest of the class laughed. They knew what I was getting at. And I did say before the class finished, I said, but in a bodhisattva, you're only allowed to be bodhisattva of the year once. So next year, let somebody else take that terrible position. So anyway, that was just looking at the past and just twisting it around to make it less heavy, less painful, easier to let go of. And that's one of the things you find, to let go of the past. Please be kind to it. Be kind to all the actors who participated in that terrible experience. You can always see something positive there, somewhere. And when you can see that something positive in there somewhere, then it's easier to let that past go and be still from the past. It doesn't bother you. And then the same as the future. What's going to happen next? Oh, there's all these wars overseas, all the economic terrible things, all the pandemics happening, the masks are not going to stop you, the rat tests are not going to stop you. It didn't stop the mice in my hut this morning. I thought you'd give a rat test, but there's a mice in there. anyway, I think it was given a holiday. Is that correct? Where did you take it? Not in the monks' monastery, across the road. Yeah, okay, it's a nice new home. Yeah. Oh, very good, excellent. It's really interesting being Buddhist, what we do with animals like mice, because you can't leave them in places like the kitchen or something or whatever, because you know people say that's unhealthy and get in big trouble. So what we usually do when we do catch them, that if you had time, the usual place we let them go. You know the usual place where we let the mice go? Yeah, Karnak prison farm. It's logical. They've done bad karma. They need to do some time in jail. Even when I was in Thailand, we used to catch the mice. You know what we did once? Because they said, oh, you let them go, they'll all come back. And then, so... So it was my idea, so I had to do it. We had a tin of paint and a little brush, and I had to paint the mice's ears. The mice didn't like having their ears painted. And it's really kind of tried to dab it here, and it just ran over to the other side of the cage, and dab it over there, and then run away again. It took forever to just paint the mice's ears. And then we let it go, because there were not that many mice with painted ears in Thailand. So we thought, if they come back, we know it's them. I don't think they ever did come back. Probably embarrassed. Anyway, so I'm supposed to be talking about meditation, yeah. I do this on purpose, because when you're laughing and happier, it's easier to meditate. You be kind to the past. Kind to the future. Don't know what's going to happen next. I never do. But then you're kind to the future. You can handle it some way or other. Especially like all the people who come to places like this are always very kind, good people. I know your kindness, your goodness. I've known many of you for such a long time. And so when you start to tap into kindness, your own kindness, you find you don't have much to fear about the future at all. What could go wrong? Everything. But so what? I think even, I know yesterday I to the monks, to say that we don't have the word wrong in Buddhism, not in the way I look at life. The way I look at life, nothing goes wrong, it just goes unexpectedly. Sometimes more of a challenge, differently. It's not wrong, it's here. And so you make the best use of it. See what happens next. So the idea when you take that word wrong out of your vocabulary, you say different, a challenge, see what happens next. It's not wrong to get sick. Any of you who get sick, it's right to be sick, it's what the body does. It's not wrong that you're terminal. That's one of my problems. I feel much better these days, but when I used to go to airports, I was really afraid of getting... I never said it. What? Terminal illness. But when you're afraid, that's when bad things happen. When you have this sense of fun in life, see how long life lasts, and make the best use of it, then you find out that that peace and stillness which comes from that is a result of being kind to the future. You're here for a few more days? I don't know, but look at this place. You can't be in a better place. You know, this is, people are very kind here. Do nice chanting in the morning, good food, good company. No one says any bad words about you because they're in noble silence. You know, You're not going to get paid afterwards, so you're not going to lose anything. It's a beautiful holiday. Sometimes that people don't realize just how when you go on a retreat, it really is a retreat from the world. It's one of the best holidays you can do in the whole world. Get up when you want. Go to bed when you want. Eat. Be entertained, morning and evening. And at the same time getting some deep teachings in there and feeling your body relax and your mind relax. That is kindness. And when you're kind to the past and the future, it's easy to let it go. But also be kind to the present moment. Look upon what you're experiencing right now, this beautiful kindness, gentleness, openness. Listen to the birds in the morning with kindness. Feel the wind, the coolness of the temperature in the morning. I must admit, I just really indulge in that. I love the weather this time of year. That's why I just wear bare shoulders. I try not to wear shoes when I'm in this compound here. I love feeling the sensation of this floor or carpet or the concrete under my feet. It's a beautiful feeling. It's sensitive. And it's not hard or anything. It's just, I say it's invigorating. So when I can feel things and it's delightful, you really enjoy it. It's such a simple pleasure of just experiencing the cold or the softness or whatever it is, or having your shower, all that beautiful hot water just rolling off your body. Be aware and be kind, and you find you get joy. But of course, it's much more than that, which is one of the reasons why I started off with the idea of telling that story of when I was in that Zen monastery in the north of England. And in a Zen monastery, I was courageous, adventurous enough to try anything. And you were young and you're healthy, and you thought, well, why not do a Zen retreat? And on that Zen retreat, we were instructed to keep our eyes open and to stare at a wall all day, basically. You get up for 10 minutes and do your walking meditation all together, and then sit down again and stare at the wall. And I wasn't told what to expect, which was important. If I tell you what to expect, then sometimes people imagine it, and they make it happen, or they get disappointed when it doesn't happen. So it's nice when you don't give like those sorts of instructions, do this and you get that, do that and then you get this. Instead, the adventure, the exploration of a meditation retreat and see what happens is much better. So anyway, I had my eyes open, fully open, watching a wall for hours every day. But then what happened? It's only about the second day or something. I was just sitting there, just watching the wall. It wasn't an interesting wall. It was an old barn, an old shed for cows or something, and I had people in it. I think the cows were outside enjoying the sunshine. But anyway, just watching this wall, just whitewashed. Then the wall disappeared. My eyes were fully open, but then the wall had gone. It was like a magic trick. How can you make a wall vanish? Look at it with a still mind long enough. And I wasn't afraid. That was a nice thing. Instead, I thought, wow, this is interesting. What's happening? And I soon realized that, number one, I'd done enough meditation before. I knew how to keep my thoughts calm down. So I wasn't thinking or fantasizing or dreaming or whatever. I was just there, mindful in the moment, just watching a wall. And then it wasn't there anymore. What was I seeing? I was seeing nothing. And what had happened was so similar. I didn't recognize this at the time, only later. Same as when I closed my eyelids. If you've got your eyelids open, then you close it. You can see the inside of your eyelids. There's a little bit of light which shines through the very thin membrane of the eyelids. But the point is, it doesn't do anything. It doesn't move. It doesn't change. That perception or sensation of sight of the inside of your eyelids doesn't move. It is still. I get my eyes open, then I can see people, and there's diversity there. But when there's unity, just the, and the very simple, doesn't change, doesn't move, it vanishes. And to see a whole wall vanish like that with your eyes open was always quite astounding, but that's what happens. And it showed me that it's stillness which allows things to vanish. If you're kind to the past, it doesn't have any busyness for you. It doesn't demand your attention. You don't have to solve problems when you're kind to things. Which means that it's much more likely to vanish. The future, if you stop projecting all sorts of other things which might happen, just be kind and just say, oh, I don't know. There's nothing to think about. And therefore your thinking of the future stops. It vanishes. All you've got left is this present moment. You start watching your body. I love doing that. Beginning of the meditation. Just staying with my body, feeling it, understanding it, getting to know it, not judge it. Getting to know, how does your body feel right now? Any aches or pains there somewhere? Any tightness, tension? Loosen it off. I stretch my back. Oh, that feels really good. And after a while, my body, when I start meditating, feels so relaxed. And I mean that. Which means that it disappears. It's not a problem. It doesn't create busyness for me. And because of that, it just disappears. It vanishes. And I love that idea of stillness leading to vanishing. So my body is not a problem anymore during the meditation. The first time I learned that, good old Ajahn Chah again. You know, some of these teachers, I thought they were, please excuse me, Ajahn Chah, sadistic. It wouldn't hit me, but what he would do, like all the monks when we started this monastery in the jungle, and it really was a jungle in those days, this big, snakes all over the place. One of the first really big snakes, only a python, but it was huge. And what scared me most was not just how big it was, but when it saw me, the python, you know, was really scared, and it just darted in the opposite direction. Fast. There's no way I could outrun that thing. It was huge, but very dangerous. But anyway, he left me alone. I think I only wanted a bit of a cuddle, that's all. Anyway, so when you learnt, you know, you were in this jungle monastery, Ajahn Chah wanted to have everybody meditating together every evening for 2-hour meditation. That's a long time. But the worst part of it wasn't the time. It was not the length of time we sat, but the time of the day when we meditated. That was 6 o'clock to 8 o'clock, and afterwards going to do some chanting or something. That's mosquito dinner time. That's when they all come out. And there was hundreds of them. I mean, literally. I mean, I somebody said you can't trust your memory, but I think this is pretty accurate. Just a way of passing the time, because you know, trying to meditate was counting the number of mosquitoes on your arm and your head and your shoulder at one time. And they've got about 60 or 70 of them. You can actually hear the shh, all the blood being sucked out. Now that is an exaggeration. And so often you would have a look at your teacher, and he was sitting there, eyes closed, perfectly happy. If he wasn't sitting there, I'd have run away. You couldn't stand that. That was just too hard. But then, thank you, dear Ajahn Chah, for making us do that. Because the only way I could cope was actually to go inside. Just to meditate properly. To start just really relaxing. Going into the breath at that time, I was really into the breath. Just watching the breath go in and go out. Until you couldn't feel the mosquitoes anymore. They were there. But you were just going so deep inside. You had the breath, and you always had this beautiful meditations at that time. Couldn't feel the body. And you had times when you're meditating, you're not asleep, you're perfectly aware. You can't feel your hands, you can't feel your nose, which is itchy just now. Can't feel your legs. All that stuff disappears. And that sort of, those mosquitoes were teaching me how to do that. Because the alternative was, so little by little those mosquitoes taught me how to be still enough that my body could vanish. And all those teachings, they taught me the power of stillness. Stillness is caused by mindfulness and kindness. That cup hasn't moved since I put it down. You're kind, you're aware. It keeps perfectly still. And now the water starts to disappear. But that disappearing act, that's what meditation is all about. Your five senses disappear, your body vanishes. What have you got left? You got your mind. Little by little, what do you do next? You're sitting here, nice and still, body not causing you any trouble at all. With your mind, see if you can let that be still. Put down the past, put down the future, be kind to this moment. Whatever you're experiencing right now, be kind to it. It's come to teach you something. The most important part is you don't react to it. Because every time you react, it's like picking up the cup. You move your mind and you lose your stillness. And little by little, your mind gets more and more still. More still than you've ever experienced it before. And it's gorgeous. The more still it becomes, the more profound, the more powerful, the more joyful. That's the nature of this. It's one of the reasons why during the interviews when people come up and ask, Ajahn Bam, I had a really, really deep meditation. And said, I'm sure it must have been at least the sixth jhana. Honestly, the first thing I do is just look at their face. Look at the way they talk. There's this gentleman years and years and years ago, and I asked him, I wasn't a senior monk at the time, but I asked him, how's your meditation going during a retreat? He said, a bit disappointing. I said, oh, well, what's happening? He said, well, I can only get into the first jhana, I can't get the second. As soon as he said that, I realized I had no idea what jhanas were, honestly. If you just get even to the first jhana, you're blissed out. You're walking on air. You just, oh, this is lovely. Oh, oh. He said, I'm disappointed. You can't be disappointed if you just get first jhana and just you're blissed out. Later on, maybe say, well, maybe it could have got deeper, but that was really nice. So little by little, it's the joy and the happiness which comes up, which is one of the biggest indicators you're getting into deep meditation. And it doesn't just last when you're meditating, it's afterwards as well. It's one of the reasons why after a good meditation, talking is just so coarse. And sound is just so... Yeah. You love silence. You love peace. It's gorgeous. You don't have to communicate with another person by using words. If you ever talk to someone, you know the words you chose were not quite correct. They didn't really convey just what you really wanted to tell another person. But sometimes, just know the body language, the eyes, the tone of your voice, but even more powerful than that, know where it's coming from, the mind-to-mind thing. That says much more. That's more powerful. And for a lot of times, when you're giving a talk or after a deep meditation, that's all you really need. Just a little bit of peace, a smile. Anyone who's sensitive enough knows what's happened. So little by little, this is about disappearing. Things vanishing, your body going, time going. I love those experiences, again, when people sit here and they sit here for hours. I know these are old stories, but I'm going to tell this one again about this Vietnamese Theravada monk over in Sydney. Taught a 9-day retreat. First day of the retreat, you know what we did yesterday? And just when the monk gave a talk, he said, we'll meditate first of all for half an hour, then we'll do the talk. It took another 8 days before he gave the talk. He just sat there. Imagine that. You're supposed to be giving a talk, you're just sitting here. After the half an hour, no bell goes, and all the people looking at him, waiting what's going on. And eventually they just, a few of them meditated, most of them went to bed. And they got up in the morning, he was still sitting there, he hadn't moved. He did that for 8 days. Didn't move from his seat. No water, no food, no going to toilet. Just sitting there, like a Buddha statue. And when he came out of his meditation, the first thing he did was to apologize. I was supposed to have given a talk, sorry. He just got into a very peaceful meditation. Didn't need to eat or sleep or go to toilet or anything. These are real things. People saw it. And afterwards they said, no, that was really inspiring. You didn't teach us Dhamma with words. You taught us so much just by seeing you sitting there with such kindness and peace. And that was very impressive that people can still do that these days. You think you get the message there, stillness, brings that sort of peace and happiness and safety, which means that that's very inspirational for others and for you as well. So little by little, as you're sitting here, be kind to the past, be kind to the future, be kind to the present. And if there's any problems at all in the meditation, it's usually because you're not kind enough. Kindness is what relaxes things, loosens things. Always, this is the cold time of the year now, so you won't see any snakes. But there used to be the dugongs over here in China Grove. Did anybody see it in the summertime? I haven't heard anyone seen it. But it was very nice, on a very hot weather the year before that. It's this beautiful snake. And it's very beautiful, but it's very venomous. But it just sits there in the sunshine, or lays there in the sunshine. People go up and say hello to it. It doesn't move, it just sits there. It's just a beautiful little thing. And you get the feeling from it. It's so passive, so kind. It's been here long enough now that it is a Buddhist snake. So I'm sure you're all very, very, very safe with it. And that sort of that kindness and the gentleness which we have, that makes the snake feel safe, so it can relax. The gentleness and kindness which you give to your own body and mind makes the body relaxed and makes the mind feel free. You don't have to do anything or to struggle or to squirm to get safety and peace. This place is one of the safest places in the whole world. So when you're here, relax. You sit and close your eyes, relax into the present moment. Try not to do anything, try not to be in control. Just sit there and be aware and be kind. Make peace, be kind, be gentle. You know where that comes from? Sometimes I've seen that on people's t-shirts. From Ajahn Brahm said, make peace, be kind, be gentle. No. That's plagiarism. That was said by the Buddha. Second factor of the Eightfold Path. That's how powerful it is. Make peace, be kind, be gentle. That's my translation of the three Sammasankappas. Renunciation. Let go. Make peace with things. Let go. Be kind. Be gentle. That's how the Buddha taught. So you know what to do. So for the rest of this retreat, what should you be doing? Making peace. Being kind. And being gentle. In every moment. See what happens. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. That's great. Good old Stefan Dhammawuddo at the back there. You know, he was missing for 2 or 3 years because couldn't get a visa to come into Australia. But you know, his sadhu, sadhu, sadhu became so famous, you know, after lunch or after offering the food at a Buddha, a Bodhinyana, that people actually missed you. When as soon as you came back again, I was just watching them, even yesterday. Watching them, and as soon as you did your sadhu, 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 they were always laughing and say, oh yeah, he's back again. It creates joy and happiness. Put a bit of effort and sadhu, sadhu. So let's do it one more time. Sadhu, sadhu. A big one. Sadhu. Very good. Okay. So have a wonderful meditation and nice time. And there's no interviews on the first day, but the interviews will start tomorrow on Saturday. Yeah. Excellent. So have a wonderful morning and lunch, and I'll see you around. Very good. I'm looking at some stuff.